Ruth Clare grew up in outer suburban Brisbane until her family moved to Rockhampton. Her dad owned a mini-mix truck, then he took over a bakery, and then he became a TAFE teacher. Mum looked after the house and brought up the kids. From the outside, everything looked pretty straightforward. But Ruth and her siblings spent their childhood terrified of their father, who punished the slightest infraction with terrible violence. A spilt drink, a little bit of mess, a slow response could result in a series of hard beatings. Ruth's dad also had moments where he could be sweet and gentle, and it was hard for Ruth to understand where the violence was coming from. Like most kids, she was inclined to blame herself. No one ever told Ruth the way her dad behaved might have something to do with the fact that he was a veteran of the Vietnam War. Ruth was only able to see the connection when she had kids of her own, and after she was able to speak to other veterans who had come to terms with what had happened to them. Ruth's memoir is called Enemy, a daughter's story of how her father brought the Vietnam War home. Hi, Ruth.
Hey.
Your dad had this lovely childhood growing up on a property near Sandgate outside of Brisbane with horses and chickens and cubby houses and all that. But his birthday fell on one of those days picked out in the National Lottery for National Service, and he was sent off to Vietnam. How old was your dad when he was sent to Vietnam?
Well, he was 20 that his number got drawn out, but he was in the middle of an apprenticeship, which you could choose to defer the time that you started in the army. So he served in 1968, although I think his number was drawn out in 1966.
So he was about 23 when he went to Vietnam.
23.
Did he mind being conscripted?
I don't fully know the answer to that, but he said that he thought that he was doing his bit for the country. So, you know, his uncle had fought in the war, his grandfather had fought in the war. He thought he was doing his thing for the country.
He fought in the Battle of Coral, which is not well remembered, I don't think. This was a battle where Australian soldiers held off Vietnamese soldiers for days and days and days.
So they came up the first night, over 100 of the enemy swarmed over this camp. They'd unfortunately set up in the middle of a Viet Cong headquarters. And I saw this footage of one of the guys who was there, one of the North Vietnamese soldiers, and he was saying that they were all in the trees watching them set up the camp. And that night I know, it was chilling. And then that night, apparently there was a war cry and the guys were just in, it was around midnight, had set up and they swarmed over the camp and then overran the guys and went to get the big guns. And one was overtaken. And then they won that gun back. But then the next night they came again, hundreds of swarming in to the camp, and they defended that. And then the next night they came again. And so 26 days of this happening. And it was the first time in since World War II that they used all the aspects of the, like the tanks came in and the Air Force came in, and it all was a coordinated attack because it was such a huge attack.
So this meant your dad would have spent days awake fighting in combat, day after day after day, getting almost no sleep at all. Did he see friends die beside him?
I know that his best friend died over there. That was one of the things he did discuss with us. He said that his best friend said to him, "Dig, you bastard, dig," and then the next minute was shot down and in front of him.
And how was he when he was telling you about that? Was he emotional or was he cool with that?
It was kind of a brief moment of telling and then a complete withdrawal.
You had the sense of someone creeping out of something and then going back inside again?
Going straight back inside.
When he came back, he married your mum. Had they been together before he went to Vietnam?
Yeah, so they were engaged before, and then when he came back, they got married.
Did your mum ever speak about what he was like before he went to war?
Yeah, she said they was a real larrikin and always up for fun and a good time. But she knew that he'd changed straight away. But she felt out of loyalty that she should stay with him because it wasn't his fault that he'd gone over there.
You came into the world along with your siblings. Are all your earliest memories as a child sort of bound up in violence?
Mostly. That's the nature of how your brain works, is that when you're really frightened, you're biologically designed to remember those moments. And so it's really hard to remember any moment vividly that doesn't have some fear attached to it.
What kind of rules did you set for yourself, Ruth, in dealing with your father?
Well, I tried to figure out what he wanted from us, and so I tried to make his behaviour make sense. You have to come within 5 seconds. He expects you to come. You drop whatever you're doing and run to him if you can't get there, yelling, "Coming, Dad!" You have the immediacy of response was really important. I never could quite figure out what the right response was if you did something wrong, because if you did something wrong and admitted it, you got hit. If you did something wrong and you lied about it, you got hit. If you did something wrong and you didn't say something quick enough or in the right tone, you got hit. So I could never quite figure out all the rules.
I have to ask this question, but when you say hit, like how hard are we talking about here? Is this slapping or punching or kicking or what?
Well, it varied depending on what it was. Sometimes it tried to figure out if your response made it worse. Sometimes it was just a few smacks. Other times he would punch you and then...
Punch you as a little girl?
Yeah, it would just be closed. Grab your arm. He wanted to hold you where you were, hold your arm and then punch. You know, my first ever memory is of, for me, it was the most terrifying time when he chased me through the house and I kept trying to hide and he kept dragging me out. And the shaking, there was a lot of shaking as well. And that's really difficult to be inside your head when it's moving around that much.
And when he did that, Ruth, was he in an absolute rage or was there something frighteningly cold about it?
The thing that used to piss me off the most was that he seemed to beat you to a rhythm of his words, to emphatically pound his words into you. I'm right, going like to da-da-da.
So like there's control in that then, in other words.
So there is an aspect of control, but his eyes were not control. His eyes always, when he was in those rages, looked reptilian to me.
Afterwards, was he ever apologetic?
He was never apologetic, but he might say, "I'm sorry you made me do that," or "that hurt me more than it hurt you." It was like he crumpled afterwards and he became smaller, but it didn't feel like it extended to me. That feeling, whatever had changed within him, didn't feel like it was directed to
him. Would you say things like, you know, no hard feelings or anything like that? You know,
no, not even.
Was it just you or was it you and your brother and sister?
All of us.
How about your mum?
Well, no, when he was living with us, he never hit her.
Tell me about the day you cut your foot while running around in the house.
So we just moved to Rockhampton. I was 5 and there was all packing boxes everywhere and I was playing a game where I was running through the house, jumping over this, tripping over that, go around this, tag that, keep going back and forth on this loop. And Dad and Mum kept shouting out, "Stop running through the house," but on this last run, I ended up putting my foot down on a metal bracket that held the washing machine that was lying on the ground. And initially I thought, I put my foot down, I was like, that hurt, but I couldn't see any blood. And then the next minute, there was a lot of blood pouring out of my foot. And so I screamed out, "Help!" And I heard the house thundering with someone running to me. And I thought, okay, someone's coming. They've got bandages ready for this terrible injury. And it was Dad, and he was so furious at me for not listening to him that he just said, "You deserve that. You didn't listen to me. No one's going to help you. Walk to school on your foot. I don't care." And he went away, got a towel, threw it at me, and I wasn't meant to ask for help. So I was trying to figure out what to do. I had all this blood on my foot and I kept sort of fading in and out of the experience because I kept looking at the blood and it was totally freaking me out. And then Mum walked by and I said, "Mum, what am I meant to do? My foot keeps bleeding." She said, "Well, I don't know." And she tried to help me quietly wrap the towel around my foot. Dad had said I was meant to go to school and I was meant to walk on the foot to punish me for not listening to him. And I was like, I can't walk on the foot. And so Mum ended up putting me in a pram, which was I was really humiliated to be put in a pram because I was at a new school and I was wearing some blue thongs and I noticed that the foot continued to bleed and bleed and the thong turned red, the whole strap of the thong was stained red and Kirsten and I ended up saying, "Oh, well, at least we got a red thong. I always wanted red thongs," so.
You must have been about to faint from blood loss too, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that day was really marked by this weird fog that kept You know, it's like very dreamlike state where it kept sort of creeping around the edge of my vision. And so I remember being home, but I don't remember how I got home, and my foot was bandaged, but I don't remember who did it. Someone, I think, said she needs stitches, but, you know, it was very in and out.
Was your mum able to step between you and your father?
No.
What would she do when these beatings were happening?
You know, it was so intense, and it was so, my vision was so narrowed to me and Dad. I didn't even think most times to even look where Mum was. But I knew from the second I was able to know anything that there was no way Mum was ever going to stand up to Dad. Not a chance.
How good did you get at reading your dad's body language?
Pretty good.
What kind of things would you look for?
His pulse, under his skin, often the way he's holding his mouth, whether or not it looks like it's, you know, you can almost see the expression underneath. If there's an expression underneath the one that he's wearing, like a sneer, then you better watch out. If his fist starts curling or you feel tension in his hands, you better watch out. He would cross his legs really quickly. You would notice there'd just be a few breaths. He was getting more and more worked up.
Could you ever relax in his presence?
Not fully.
They often say that children grow up in violent households. They have this constant stimulation of the fight or flight response. Like you're always like ready to waiting for something to happen. Is that you?
Very much. So if I get triggered, I can still get triggered like that and have the constantly watching, not feeling safe, constantly having to check people.
You look for explanations for why you're getting beaten. What kind of explanations did you come up with when you were little?
That I was bad, that I could never do anything right, that he didn't love me, that I deserved to be punished just for being alive, that he didn't want me.
But there were moments when you thought you could see him really respond to you. Like, tell me about the school project you did with him about eucalyptus trees.
I loved school. You know, you had these pieces of cardboard and you would choose a topic and you would have to stand up and have notes in front of the class and do a little lecturette. We used to call them the lecturettes. I loved these things because you kind of got to perform in front of the class. And I was looking for a topic and I said, Dad, what do you think I should do for a topic? And he said, what about eucalypts? And I thought, oh, that sounds really boring. And then he said, come on, hop in the car, I'll take you to the bush. He walked me into the bush and I sort of thought, well, this is just like one type of eucalypt. It's obviously all this kind of grey. And then he showed me through and showed me all the different leaves and crushed them and showed me all the different scents and told me all their Latin names. It just was so exciting to have him. A, school was my thing and he was showing some interest in my thing, and that it was just me and him in the bush on the afternoon. So I went to the library the next day and got the book out and made sure I knew all the Latin names, because he'd used Latin names and I was so impressed with his Latin names that I learnt them as well. And I stood up in front of the class and I practiced it so much and I wanted to do such a good job to show him how much I appreciated it that I ended up getting 40 out of 30.
40 out of 30? How do you get 40 out of 30? But that's really lovely. And what happened when you came home with the news?
Well, he was initially like really happy, 40 out of 30. So I was thinking this was the start of our new relationship. And it ended up that when I had my report card, I got this report card and it's all full of A's. And it just feels so exciting when you've actually, I feel like I've figured school out. I couldn't figure out home, but
like you're validated as a human being.
Totally valid. Yeah. It's like, oh, right, you do what they say and you get an A. Yes, I know this place. So I was so excited to show him my report card and I got an A+ for presentations and I was like, that's our mark. And that day he walked in the door and I should have read the situation better, but he was already in a mood and I basically jumped out at him and that just startled him and didn't make the mood any better. And he was just trying to ignore me, but I was so excited to show him. And I was watching him as he kind of flicked through the paper and all of these things. I was watching him going, get my report, the report. I'd left it on the table displayed so he could see it. And then I eventually said, did you see my report? And he just looked at it and went, oh, yeah. And he said, where's your sister's? then I started sort of going, did you notice all the A's? Did you see that was our A+? And he just turned to me and said, I work with a bunch of dickheads and they all went to university and going to school doesn't make you smart. And he tapped me on my temple, like, you can't even remember to bring your lunchbox. Remembering to bring your lunchbox makes you smart. So that was pretty much the end of him helping me with school.
What did you take away from that? He was telling you, well, you're not as smart as you think you are if you don't remember your lunchbox.
I thought I probably wasn't as smart as I thought I was for not remembering my lunchbox.
You believed him.
Yeah.
One day he said he wanted to comb the knots out of your hair. Was that lovely or terrifying?
It was completely bamboozling.
Mm.
Dad barely ever looked in a mirror. His idea of dressing up was putting on stubbies and thongs and tucking in whatever faded polo shirt he had at hand, you know, and combing his hair. That's it.
Right. Bit of Californian poppy. No, that's it. Right.
And I'm like, Dad wants to comb my hair. And I just thought, I don't want you touching my hair. But he was saying, okay, come on. Do you want me to do this? I'm like in my head going, no, thanks. But okay, you didn't fight Dad. So I went and washed my hair and lied down, and it became this kind of performance piece for the afternoon. The whole family gathered around me as I lay on the floor, and Dad got this leave-in conditioner and combed my hair and kept combing it until it dried. So it was quite a long, and I was the whole time going, oh my God, what am I going to do wrong? And what's going to happen here?
Well, you were rigid with fear.
Oh, the whole time just going, what? I'm going to do something wrong. I'm going to be lying. Something is going to annoy him and I'm lying on the floor and something's going to happen. And then at the end of it, he was just like, there, that looks nice. And I was like, oh my God, I could have enjoyed that maybe if I had have known that that was going to be the outcome.
Tell me about the time when you wanted to make coffee for your mum and dad while they were watching TV. It's an illustration of that really narrow place you had to live in at the time.
I mostly spent my childhood sleeping over other people's houses because it was a lot less stressful. But this was if we were at home, we often worked in the garden, did, you know, mowing the yard and digging stuff and whatever.
Keeping out of Dad's way, right?
Yeah. And we'd all been working out in the garden and we'd all come in and had showers and we were watching David Attenborough. And it was, in my mind, it was this lovely family moment. And I thought, I'm going to make Mum and Dad some coffee. So I was like, would you like coffee? And Mum was like, yes, someone else can make me coffee. And Dad was like, great, let's make coffee. So I'd gone in and, you know, I was having this real little moment with myself about lovely family and I was being really careful not to spill it. I'd done a really good job of carrying it out there. And I was all in this headspace of how lovely it all was. And I looked up and Dad was staring at me with just fury. And it was so shocking, I couldn't even imagine what I'd done wrong, that I felt myself kind of vacuumed out of my body, but I didn't dare do anything differently because I thought I'd spill the cups. And so I kept walking forward really tentatively, really like sort of surreptitiously looking behind me, making sure I hadn't spilled anything. The next minute he's up out of his chair in this really fast movement, and then he comes behind me and he puts his hands over the cups and goes, walk, walk, not like that, walk like this, like a normal person. And he was just furious that I was looking so tentative. That's the only thing I could imagine, is that me, I don't know, looking unsure of myself just made him feel really something.
Well, he frog-marched you.
He frog-marched me
right
over to the table and basically all the coffee spilled all over me and sloshed. And then he said, just clean it up, as if I'd made the mess on purpose or I was trying so carefully not to make a mess.
So he was barking at you for being timid.
Too timid, I think.
But then you weren't allowed to make a mess either.
No mess. You know, and you were meant to be confident but not a show-off. And all of these things, it was like, you're not allowed to make mistakes. You're not allowed to fumble. You're not allowed to be timid. But then if you think you're too good, then you're up yourself and you're not allowed to be that either.
There's no space you can live in between those competing imperatives.
No.
As a kid. When did you first get an inkling that he was seeing a girlfriend?
This girl that Dad, I think, worked with had started sort of coming around to our house, and one day I was watching a musical on telly and Kirsten, she was 2 years older than me, and this girl was sitting at the table and I heard this, did you know your dad's got a girlfriend, sort of float over to me. I was half eavesdropping on them, half watching. I looked over and then I looked away because I thought I didn't want them to know I was eavesdropping and I wanted to know more about what was going on. And I saw Kirsten kind of going, shh, shh, and then they went to a different room. And so I just sort of went, I must have got that completely wrong because fathers don't have girlfriends, they've got wives, and that wife is my mother.
How did you discover he was leaving home?
Well, they started a series of whisper fighting.
When you picked that up?
Well, yeah, we were all lying in bed awake all night listening to this circular argument every single night, the same sort of territory. And then that stopped and I thought, oh, well, that's over. That sort of fight is finished and now we're moving on. And then Mum came into the kitchen one afternoon when Kirsten, David and I were there and she said, I've got something to tell you. Your dad's going away and he's not coming back.
What was the first thing you thought or felt when you heard that?
Well, firstly, I was just sort of looking around going, what is everyone else thinking about this? What am I meant to think about this? And then the thing that came up in me was, ding dong, the witch is dead. I just thought, oh my God, our life is going to be so much less stressful. So I was just imagining, you know, he used to go away on fishing trips sometimes and the house was like lying around, eating pizza, kind of watching telly and just chilling out. I was like, yes, we're going to get that.
So what happened when he came to get his stuff?
We knew he was coming back that night and we were just all watching, waiting, looking at the door, not knowing what to do, not knowing if we were meant to know or not meant to know. And we were just listening and we heard him come in and heard him scrabbling around under the house and then heard him walk into the house and we're like, okay, he's going to say something. No, he walks past. And then eventually he said, kids, sorry about this. Be good to your mother. Goodbye. And then that was it. And then we went to the window to watch him. And then there was this series of him loading all this stuff onto the truck. I thought it was going to be like a quick dramatic exit, but it was like more stuff on there, just watching, going, okay, this is taking longer than I thought, which was like a really awful childish thing. But it was like, oh, I expected, you know, a bit more like the movies. And then he went away.
You had that kind of feeling, you said, you know, ding dong, the witch is dead. Hooray. Did you also feel a little guilty about that feeling?
I felt terribly guilty. You know, because Kirsten was crying and, you know, David looked really distressed. And I was just thinking, oh, my God, it's going to be so much better. And I felt bad.
And what state was your mum in as he was grabbing all this stuff and then leaving for good?
Just nothing. She was frozen. Mum's general response is to freeze, and it was just frozen.
How did she finally break down? How did you see that?
Well, she started drinking a lot all the time and drinking and drinking and sobbing her heart out for 2 solid years of crying and drinking.
2 solid years. From your perspective now, what do you think she was crying over?
I think her identity was really strongly tied to Dad. I don't think Mum had a very strong sense of self. And I think that she thought of herself as Doug Callum's wife. And that she hadn't left him despite everything. She was willing to be her life vision was that they were together until they died. And I don't think she'd ever thought that it would be anything different. And I just think that it completely shook her entire sense of self.
After your dad left, what did you and your mum and your 2 siblings live on?
Well, Mum got the sole parents' pension, which I think was around $7,000 a year at that stage.
That wouldn't stretch too far, would it?
No, we got strict black and white pantry.
Right, home brand everything.
Home brand everything. Mm. Yeah, money was always pretty tight.
How much of your mum's time was taken up just with drinking and crying at this time?
It was pretty full-time occupation. Mum was mostly just lying on the floor, passed out.
How old were you at this point, Ruth?
Well, Dad left when I was 11. It was like I had a 3-day window of, Dad's gone. And then I came home and heard this noise on the side veranda and went out to thinking it was some rabid dog. That was what I decided it was. And I found Mum completely drunk, sprawled, face down, sobbing and sobbing, and the air was ripe with the smell of wine, and that was just what life was like for a very long time.
Was she a big drinker before your dad left?
No. It was a total shock for that reason. My parents just never drank at home.
Who kept the show on the road then, like, you know, making dinner or lunches, breakfast, getting your kids off dressed and your clothes washed and all that stuff? Was your mum still able to do that?
Oh, well, mum definitely did the washing. So that was where she, eventually when she started hiding her drinking, that's where you would find all the empty bottles in the washing machine down there. She spent a lot of time underneath, our laundry was underneath the house. So she's
really hiding?
Hiding.
Yeah. And did she deny it?
Denied it. Right. Stupid. You know, it's like you can't even stand up and it's like, I'm not drunk.
Your dad moved in with his girlfriend, a woman called Brenda.
Mm.
Yeah. You blamed her for the...
I blamed her. The easiest thing to do as a child is to blame the person who's broken up.
Blamed her for what? Because you were happy that your dad had left. Were you blaming her for your mother's misery then, do you think?
Yeah. Because I didn't want Dad back, but I blamed her for how sad Mum was.
Despite all that, it's a hard question to ask, but did you still want to be loved by your dad?
Absolutely.
Even then?
Even then. Always. Always.
Broadcast, podcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
I'm with Ruth Clare. Ruth has written a memoir called Enemy, a daughter's story of how her father brought the Vietnam War home. When your dad started calling you at home, how was he when he called?
Well, it was always post-midnight and he was always drunk and slurring on the phone. I think it was partly the era and partly Dad, but there wasn't a regular series of visits. It was very sporadic. So he started calling, and the first time he called, I was like, Dad's on the phone, and I didn't care that it was late. He was talking about stuff, I love you kids, and it's not your fault. And then he called the next night, and I love you kids, and it's not your fault, and I'm so sorry it's happened this way. And then he called the next night. And it was just eventually Kirsten, David and I would, well, I felt like it was a game of who's going to take the bullet tonight. So we would be lying in bed and I was the soundest sleeper. So if I was woken up by the phone, it meant that they were both definitely awake and we'd be lying in bed going, who is going to get the phone call tonight? And I eventually would just say yes, hold the phone completely away from my ear and say, yes, Dad. I don't know why we didn't think to take the phone off the hook, but we just didn't sort of know we were allowed to not answer the phone to Dad.
When he was living with you, you said he only ever hit your kids and you never saw him hit your mum.
Mm.
That changed one night.
Mm.
Tell me about what you saw that night.
I was lying in bed and it was past midnight and I was in a dream and, one of those dreams where it starts to, is this a dream, is this reality? And then eventually I roused and was like, what could that noise be? It was like 2 a.m. and...
What was the noise like?
But it was distant. It was odd. And then I was turning back to go to sleep and then I heard, help, help. I was like, okay, someone needs help. I don't know who it is, but it's really late. So I raced out of bed before I even thought of, you know, when your body acts before you have time to think about what you're doing. And I ran down the hallway and I ran into David, my younger brother, and he was standing there frozen in the hallway and I looked at him, you know, we just had eye exchange, like, what's going on? Don't know. And then I was looking where he was, there was the fluorescent light of the kitchen was on, and then again, help, help, and I realised it was Mum. And so I sprinted to the kitchen and I saw Mum on the ground and Dad on top of Mum, kneeling on top of her and sort of pinning her to the ground. And there was puddles of beer all over the kitchen and bottles sort of strewn all over the place. And I just had no idea what to do because I'd never seen Dad touch Mum in that way or, you know, it was really confronting to see Mum on the receiving end of that. In a way that, you know, it was awful to see my brother and sister on the receiving end of it, but it felt like the world gone mad to see Mum lying down there. So I said, what are you doing? Get off her! And just pushed him to try and get him off her. And he had this look on his face that night that was lips back and eyes forward. And he basically just shoved me away and, you know, I ended up knocking my head. He hit me off and I just went back to him and started hitting him and saying, get off her, get off her. And then I realized it was futile because all of my pushing, it didn't even move. It didn't. He was like a boulder. So I ended up comforting Mum and I put her head in my lap and I said, "It's okay, Mum. It's okay. We're here. Don't worry about him." I didn't know what else to say.
And he was still kneeling on her chest?
Still kneeling on her chest while I was holding her head.
Could she breathe?
Well, he was more pinning her arms. Her legs were forward and he was pinning that with his knee. And so I got her head in my lap. And then he threw me off her and her head thudded to the ground, this awful thud. And he said, "Don't you comfort her. You won't comfort her if you know what she's done."
And what had she done in his mind?
Well, what I found out post was that she'd actually gone out on it the first date since Dad was her first boyfriend, her first lover, her first everything. And she'd gone out on her first date since him ever in her life that night. And
this was like how long after he'd left?
Years after.
Years after?
Years after.
And well, he was infuriated by the fact she'd been on a date.
I think what happened was that she called him and taunted him, trying to hurt him. I'm sure never imagining that he would respond the way that he did.
So she's in real danger here. So what did you do?
So I realised it was futile for me to keep trying to hurt Dad or get him off her. So I grabbed David and ran downstairs and went to call the police. But then I realised our phone underneath the house, you know, it's one of those old dial tones so that if you go, it would go ding, 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 upstairs. I don't know if you've ever had that dodgy system that we...
So he would have heard you call for
the police. He would have heard me call and I thought he might come down and get us. So I said, let's not call from here, let's go to a neighbour's. So I ran to our elderly next door neighbour and banged on her door and she opened the door to me and I got her to call the police from there.
And what happened when the police arrived?
Well, I came back to the house as soon as I saw the flashing lights and I didn't know where anyone was, so the house was all dark apart from the brightly lit kitchen. And I went to open the door and then Dad stepped out of the shadows. And
what was he like in the presence of the police who were standing there looking hard at him?
He looked chagrined. He was small. He was in that mode of doing whatever that is, wherever he went, he goes to when he hits people or whatever.
Right, he was sheepish.
He was sheepish, yeah. Right.
And how was your mum once the police arrived?
Totally vacant, totally absent from herself, just looked like she was a ghost of a person.
Was she badly bruised, visibly bruised and beaten in the eyes of the police?
Yeah, I mean, she had a big scratch up her arm where Dad had sort of ripped the watch off and, yeah, she was bruised. He'd been kicking her legs and her skirt was on backwards and, you know, her blouse was ripped.
And how were the police with her?
They were really nice. They said, "Do you feel safe staying here or do you want to go to a shelter?" And I said, "I think we should go to a shelter."
You said that.
She was just blank. She didn't have any words. She was just standing vacantly staring. So I said, "I think we should go to the shelter."
What was your night in the women's shelter like?
Well, I kind of expected a shelter to be a bit prisoner cell block H, you know, with guards, but it was just a suburban house. We just a little room with four beds, so we all got to stay in the four beds.
In all honesty, seeing your mum like that, did you think to yourself, whatever I do, I don't want to be in her position, fairly or unfairly?
Not really. I have never identified with mum really one iota, and so the idea of me having to tell myself that, it's like as if I'm ever going to be in that position. So it never occurred to me that I had to counsel myself that I'm not going to be like Dad, because my fear is that I'm going to be like Dad. I'm far more feisty and prone to anger and I'm far more his personality type than I am Mum's. So that's a much bigger fear for me, that I'd end up like Dad than I would like Mum.
You write that she went to Brisbane for a while to wean herself off alcohol.
Mm. At the end of year 11, Mum said, "I'm going to go to Brisbane." And I said, "Well, I'm not coming with you because I've got to do my fun." You know, I was still really good at school and still loved school and I was scared that if I moved school then I would not have a chance to do well in my final year. So I said, "I'm staying." And she was like, "Oh, all right, how's that going to work?" And I worked out all of the arguments she might have about that, about how we would afford it. And she was going to stay with Grandma and Grandpa. And I said, "As long as we can live in this house and just pay the bills," I was getting Austudy and I had a job, and "we can make it work." So she took David and Kirsten and I stayed in the house.
Was that a source of concern for the school or something, or adults around you, that there were...
No one had any idea.
Right, you kept that hidden?
Well, it wasn't even keeping it hidden. It's like, it was no different than having someone unconscious on the floor than having no one there. to me.
So eventually you went to university, did a science degree, graduated in that, then took up acting for a while. When you were 18, you write that you confronted your father in a phone call about you were adult enough, if you like, and big and strong enough and distant enough to be able to confront him about the times he beat you. What did he say when you put it to him that he'd beaten you just way too hard as a kid?
Well, he had called me. He was sad. He called with this little hurt voice and said, I'd been up to Rockhampton and I saw Kirsten. I didn't even think to see Dad because I was furious. By this stage, my fury had...
Right, you'd figured it out that it's not really, it wasn't
Hang
your
on.
Fault. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. You're a dickhead. I hate you. Yeah. So he called and he said, I'm really hurt you didn't come to see me. And that voice of him having the audacity to tell me that he was hurt that I hadn't gone to see him, I just lost it and just went, do you remember the time you beat me up when I was two? Do you remember when this happened? Do you remember this happened? And I started listing incident after incident. And I was like, do you? And he's like, no. And I just went, no. How is that an answer? How is that possible?
Do you think he genuinely didn't remember it?
I'm still unsure, but...
Sometimes, the reason why I say this, because I think sometimes when people do those things, they go, well, that wasn't me, that was bad me, or something.
Yeah.
It wasn't really me that did that. I wasn't myself when I did that, or something. Sometimes people are like that, aren't they?
I have asked so many people about the nature of dissociation, and is it possible that somebody is in a dissociated state, you know, with post-traumatic stress disorder? I've tried to picture it in so many ways. Does those experiences live in a bubble that's outside of your conscious awareness and you have a bridge? I can't tell you ever definitively whether or not it's true. And maybe if he went to therapy and unlocked whatever part of himself was keeping all of his trauma at bay, that maybe the other stuff lived there too. I don't know.
Years later, he rang you and told you he didn't have long to live. He was suffering from a melanoma and there wouldn't be much longer for him to live. Were you with him when he died?
Yeah. So Kirsten, David and I all went up there. So it was sort of 6 weeks from when I got that phone call to when he died.
And did he want anything from you when he was dying? Did he want to be absolved of what he'd done in any way?
He didn't even really ever recognise what he'd done. He didn't own what he'd done. He didn't apologise. You know, one time he called on his 50th birthday when he was really drunk, which I think it was probably in a blackout, he was so drunk, and said, your sister said you weren't lying. And I said, what are you talking about? Because it was 4 a.m. I'm like, okay, this is a great conversation. About me giving you a touch-up, she said you weren't lying. I'm going, oh, what, this is your acknowledgement of me saying that you beat the crap out of me as a child.
A touch-up.
Like, I initially was like, that's a creepy kind of expression, but it was like we're playing rugby and you give someone a touch up on the feet. It's like, no, you beat the crap out of me, Dad.
And even then, did you still feel, do you think, a kind of love for him, even then?
At that moment, I just felt rage at him that he would, because in my head I was like, what, so you basically have been in your head calling me a liar ever since that moment I confronted you. So at that moment, I felt extreme rage.
And when he died?
I felt guilt and loss and anger and love and hurt and bewildered.
For a long while, you weren't really interested in finding out about his war experience. You just wanted to keep a distance, obviously. You thought, just got to get past that or something? Is that what you were thinking?
I'm also very disinterested in war history.
Really? Right.
Like, I have very little, you know, it's never something I've gone, oh, I wonder what happens at war. It's like, no. But eventually it felt like it was necessary to find out. At least I was wanting to know more about the psychological damage of war.
What changed then? What changed? What made you want to look into his war history?
When I became pregnant with my first child, and I was filled with all these hormones of love, the whole world was beautiful, I just started to feel really sad that Dad had died so young, and that they say that was related to his Agent Orange exposure. And then I started to think, if I'm feeling this way about my child, did Dad ever feel this way about me? And if he didn't feel this way about me, Why was that? And I still wanted to know, can I put it down to war trauma? Is the fact that he doesn't remember, is that something I can justify for him? I really wanted to believe that. And can war trauma be an explanation for that?
And when you had a little boy and he reached that age of about around about two where they, you know, they whack things that they don't like, including mum sometimes, what was it like when he hit you with his little hand?
When he would hit me, he would, you know, it would come as a surprise. It felt to me like the exact same pattern, that I didn't know what was going to set him off, that anything could set him off, that I had to be vigilant. And, you know, especially he went through a phase of face slapping, and it was full on face slapping. And it just felt like he blamed me for every mistake he made in the world. And it just felt so familiar, that whole experience. And I just felt rage. And I thought, I had never in my life expected to feel rage like this at my child. I felt like the child. He felt like my parent. It was so psychologically taxing to be in that situation and to try and calm myself down. But he was doing it so often that my whole body would be churning with this feeling. And I'd, you know, have all these techniques I've learned in therapy of tapping and deep breathing and try and meditate with the two-year-old around. It's really not ever going to...
So this got you thinking about your father and his own feelings for his children. Mm. And this is why you wanted to know more about the experience of Vietnam veterans. How did you make contact with a Vietnam veteran?
So I just called the Vietnam Veterans Association and said I wondered if anyone might have known my dad or had... I wanted to know if they had similar experiences with their own children.
And what did they tell you, these vets you spoke to?
I spoke to one absolutely fabulous guy called Ollie, who had a lot of therapy and was able to really clearly name and own his experience. And he said that when he came back and his daughter was little, that he would sometimes lose control and hit her and then just be going, what did I do that for? And it was this wave of rage that would come on, that he wouldn't have any control. It would be so huge.
And then followed by shame.
Followed by shame and regret. It was so helpful to speak to other people and just hear that they had had problems within their own family and that it had an impact on their lives with their children as well.
And how was your dad wasn't able to, hadn't been through the therapy, he wasn't able to admit what he was doing at the time or admit what was going through his mind. How was it to hear this lovely man, Ollie, the vet, talk about this and actually say, acknowledge he had done this?
It was so healing because part of me feels like, is it a dream? Did I make it up? That he was able to name and own it felt like I could imagine that my dad, maybe if he'd had therapy, that he might either have access to those memories if they were forgotten or be shown the damage that it had caused other people. Or I don't know, that if Dad had lived, you know, he was only 52. You know, a lot of guys didn't get the counselling until, you know, around that age. If he had have had it, I don't know what might have happened in our relationship. And I like to think he might have turned out a gentler version of himself like Ollie was.
There's a growing awareness now of the trauma that those men suffered over there. They came home, there was no victory parade, they were shunned, they often didn't tell the truth about where they'd been when they ran into people they hadn't seen for a while, they were often called baby killers. Sometimes they were shunned by other veterans, older veterans, the Second World War. You heard all those stories too, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. And it's still confusing to me why.
Like you haven't been in a real war, mate. They heard, they
not,
got a bit
not
of that.
The real war was, you know, and I looked it up and, you know, so not the real war, put that into Google. It's like the idea that the war wasn't declared, is that what they meant? Or the scale, it was smaller. But for me, on an individual basis, if a person goes to war, a person goes to war, whether or not the scale of that war is this or that, it's still a war experience.
Shots are fired in anger, artillery goes off, friends die next to you, you're asked to kill other people on a battlefield. That's war. It's all war, isn't it?
That's it.
You were given a video by the Vietnam Veterans Counseling Service, which was a lecture given by a veteran called Nick Fothergill. Tell me about that video, what you saw in that, and what that told you about your father's experience.
That was an amazing thing for me to see. It was probably the most extraordinary moment of revelation for me, you know, in so many of the things I unpacked, where Nick spoke about this notion of the training that you're given in the army is as damaging as actually going to war, because what happens is in the training you're set up to develop post-traumatic stress disorder conditions, because what the training is meant to do is overcome your fight or flight response. So there is no flight in war. Flight is off the table. The only thing you're allowed to do in war is fight. That's what you're trained to do. And so therefore, he likened it to imagining a busy street outside and a car starts careening toward you. As a normal person, what you do when something's going to come at you and kill you is you run out of the way. What you have to be trained to do in combat is if somebody is carrying a gun trying to shoot you, you walk towards death. And so that means even though your whole body is saying, oh my God, get out of here, this is ridiculous, get out, you're going to be shot, you're going to be killed, it's not like that response is not happening. You just have to have trained yourself. This happens, we do that. We, you know, there's all of these techniques they teach you. You know, it's 6 months of training, and you override your natural instinct and you're ready anytime something terrifying happens, you explode into action. You don't run away from it. You explode into action again and again. Bomb goes off, move. This happens, action.
So your dad was trained, like other men who were trained at the time, to be just like one step away from being battle ready all the time.
Instead of having fight or flight, you're on standby. And standby is 1 millimeter away from fight. So flight's all the way down the other end. And you don't have any access to that because your standby is right next to your fight.
All the time. All the time.
Standby, fight. Standby, fight. This happens, fight. This happens, fight.
And that's your dad?
That's my dad. And the issue is that they get all this training to make them ready to fight. They had 6 months of training. They had a year to embed that system. If you follow this, you live. If you don't follow this, you die. Fight, fight, fight. And then they come back and they go, all right, there's 2 hours. Great. Go into community. Shh, don't talk about it. And there's no decompression. There's no training of let's bring this whole system down. Let's reset you to normal. You're back in society now. There's none of that.
Does that help you understand how he was when he was at home with you then? In standby mode all the time?
That really, really helped me. And it also helped me understand myself. The way that he required this immediacy, the immediacy of my life. It's like dad says something straight away. Do it. Doesn't matter what you're doing. Drop tools, go. You're always having to explode into action.
Right, so you lived on standby too.
We absolutely lived on standby.
You're all brought up to be living on standby.
And it's like this, it was like he was training us. He was training us to be good soldiers so we're ready for anything.
Because the world's a terrible place and your best friend might get shot.
That's right.
And you have to be ready for that.
Yep.
In a really perverse way, can you see this as a kind of act of love? Is that the word for it? Trying to prepare your... prepare your children for the terrible world he found himself in?
That's where I've come to, that feeling of if you feel like the world is not safe and the only thing to do is get your kids ready for the hard realities of life, then I think that that was part of the motivation.
Where's your fight or flight response now? I haven't helped by bringing you on
national
radio,
have I? No, this has been really terrifying. Yeah, so I, you know, keep waking up at 3 a.m. going, all right, I'm ready to fight. But, you know, it's generally pretty good.
Something you're conscious you have to manage?
Yes. Yes. I'm aware of when I feel that jittery feeling in my body and all of this nervous stuff about telling my story has really activated my fear. I'm just not sleeping, and so I've had to cut out coffee, and I'm just trying to meditate and breathing and all of those things. And there's all these tapping techniques that help to just take the energy. My body just gets really charged. My brother and sister and I, we love Dad, and it would have been a much easier process of forgiveness if he had have said, I'm sorry I did that. If you could own it, you know, it's like you want to be the person who can say it's okay. But if that person's not kind of taking their part, it makes it so much more difficult.
You said forgiveness. Have you forgiven him then?
I think forgiveness is a weird word. I think forgiveness is an odd concept because it sounds final, and I don't think it ever is a process that gets fully completed. I have an enormous amount of compassion for my dad.
Are you in a process of forgiveness then?
I am in a process of forgiveness.
It goes backwards and forwards, but it's always there.
Yeah.
I'm sure that what you've gone through and what your siblings went through is pretty common amongst other children of Vietnam veterans. What do you know about that?
The suicide rate of children of Vietnam veterans is 3 times higher than the general population. They've got 1.6 times more likely to develop drug and alcohol problems and depression. And I was involved in a study by the Department of Veterans Affairs. It was specifically about the impact of the Vietnam War on the children of Vietnam veterans. And I think it was 23% of children of Vietnam veterans said they had experienced harsh parenting, too much physical punishment, bullying, mental cruelty. I haven't spoken to all of those children, but it sounds like our childhood experiences were very similar. Not every person experiences violence, but I think every child of a veteran, not just of this war, of every war, experiences a different parent.
And if someone's listening to this who perhaps hasn't gone down that path yet of figuring out why Dad was the way he was when he came home, do you have any advice, any suggestions to people who've been through what you went through?
I think go to the Children of Vietnam Veterans Counselling Service, speak to a counsellor.
Because this is a real thing, isn't it?
It's a real thing. And for me, the impulse to do this actually came when I had children. I thought, what if I repeat this pattern? I've had so much therapy. I've had a decade of weekly therapy in my 20s. My entire 20s was pretty much devoted to therapy. And when I had kids, I was like, oh my God, I'm feeling like this and I have processed so much. What about if you've processed nothing and then you get this trigger and your children, because if you've had wounding in childhood, children are the trigger. And what do you do with that? And you just need to name it and get help.
Great to speak with you, Ruth. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.